Why is metabolomics a disrupting technology in the field of clinical chemistry? How can we leverage metabolomics to democratize healthcare? And what can we learn from bacterial metabolism to support drug development? In this episode, I discuss with Anne Bent to answer all of these questions and more as we explore her work and its impact on research in health. Welcome to Season 4 of the Metabolomist Podcast, where we explore the transformative role of metabolomics and multiomics in advancing the principles of 5P medicine. That is predictive, preventive, precision, population-based, and participatory medicine. I am your host, Alice Limonciel, and this year I will engage with leading scientists and entrepreneurs to uncover how integrative omics strategies are set to revolutionize medical research and also patient care. Join us as we delve into the latest innovations and challenges at the intersection of metabolomics and 5P medicine, shaping the future of research in health. Hello and welcome back to The Metabolomist. Today, my guest is Anne Bent. Welcome.
Hi, Alice. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. It's a long time I've been trying to get you on the podcast. And I'm really grateful that you finally accepted. And for the people who listen to the podcast regularly, you also know that Christina Legido Quigley also had a shout out to try and get you on the podcast. So I give her a bit of credit for convincing you to come. There are several reasons why I wanted to have you on the podcast. One is your focus is a lot on lipidomics, which I think is really interesting. And I always like to push that, because I see metabolomics as a mixture of small molecules and lipids, and in the cell or in our bodies, they work together. So if we can measure them together, especially if we use mass spectrometry, I think it makes sense to also try and understand them together. Also, I think you're a very vocal person in the community. I saw you gravitating from the lipidomics to the metabolomics community. Last month, you were at the metabolomics conference in Prague, and you had some good presentations there. So I thought it is now time to officially welcome you in the Metabolomist podcast. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Well, we see lipids as a subsection of the metabolites. So it's it's a natural progression. And I'm glad that the fields of lipidomics and metabolomics are moving closer. Like this, the communities, the metabolomics community and the lipidomics community, that we move closer to each other. I'm really happy about that.
Yeah. How did you end up where you are and working on the topic that you did, and how did you get acquainted with lipids and with small molecules? Can you tell us more?
Yeah. I'm in Singapore at the Singapore Lipidomics Incubator, SLING, which is a research program anchored at the National University of Singapore. And I came here 21 years ago. I am by training a microbiologist, and I did a lot in my master's and then my PhD in basically biotechnology. I've always been really fascinated by bacteria. And that's how the whole thing started. I think bacteria are really fascinating, and they can do so many things that humans cannot do. That's one thing. So I focused on how we can use bacteria for biotechnology, like weird enzymes bacteria in the Antarctic has, for example. And then I've also been really interested in host-pathogen interactions, like how do bacteria cause harm? And that is the reason why I came to Singapore, because I wanted to work on infectious diseases. And here in Singapore, the Novartis Institute, for Tropical Diseases, which was a daughter of the Novartis tasked with developing drugs for neglected diseases, and tuberculosis is one of those. It's a massive global health problem with 1.3 million people dying per year, even though we have drugs. And I wanted to help find new drug targets so that when it happens that all bacteria are resistant to the available drugs, we have something new to throw at them. I wanted to understand what kind of lipids are there and how's the lipid metabolism in mycobacteria. So the bacteria that cause tuberculosis are called mycobacteria. So the particular one is Mycobacterium tuberculosis. And I wanted to look at the lipids of mycobacteria. So hence lipidomics. Yeah, that's what I did. So I looked at the different lipids in microbacteria under different growth stages, especially in the one that is known or suspected to be the one in which the bacteria are hiding in the human body. So what you probably know is 1/3 of the world population is infected with the tuberculosis-causing bacteria, and they're hiding in the body, in the lungs and macrophages. And in this particular hiding stage, yeah, it's scary, right? In this particular hiding stage, there's in this so-called dormant phase. Yeah. And in this dormant phase, there's not much lipid metabolism going on, or any metabolism for that matter. And the idea was to find something that could target specifically these bacteria in this particular physiological state so that we could just forever eradicate tuberculosis. Mm-hmm. And that did not work out. So my first project as a postdoc didn't really work out, and we did not really find drug targets that were effective enough to really provide impact. And I then moved on to biomarker discovery to help with better diagnostics of tuberculosis.
Mm-hmm.
And so quite often we detect something, but then we don't really know how specific that is. And in this particular case, what I try to do is to look for some lipids that are only in the human body when this person is infected with mycobacteria. And we landed on mycolic acids. And mycolic acids are these really weird lipids that are making up the bulk of the cell wall of the, of the mycobacteria. So we had this method to detect these mycolic acids.
Because it's really interesting that you chose to focus on lipids for finding these bacteria and targeting it. Because usually people would focus on proteins. Is it more relevant for this type of bacteria to focus on lipids, or is it just two possibilities and you focused on one?
I think this came because I was in a lipidomics group and we were just looking for great applications for lipidomics.
Okay. Yeah, but that's also one way to go. So to follow one method and then see how applicable it is to certain questions. Okay. Very
good. And also these particular fatty acids, they were really, really stable. So that is one great thing about mycolic acids. And you might not have this with proteins or any other markers. Mycolic acids are so super stable that they've been found in Egyptian mummies. And you can still detect them.
So those little anecdotes that always to keep people a bit fascinated by the science.
Yeah. Yeah, so this was quite a wake-up call because I started all these projects on looking at the sputum patients. The sputum is the slime you cough out when you go deep into your lungs. Mm-hmm. And if you have a bacterial infection, like a mycobacterial infection, then in that sputum, you do find these mycolic acids. And we digested the heck out of it and then developed methods to do mass spectrometry to quantify these mycolic acids. And it worked well, analytically. But then the question is, how do you now bring this to where the patients are? Yeah. And how do you really use this method? Because my main motivation in life is to apply things and to not just publish it, but then really to see what do we do and how do we demonstrate the benefit of using all this taxpayers' money and all this energy we spend on a project? How do we actually show any return on investment in where it really matters and create impact? And guess what? Where the patients are, where the vast majority of tuberculosis patients are, mass spec isn't really feasible. That basically
meant. I think there are really two levels there, aren't there? Like, let's say in Singapore, in Austria, in the US, like, we're most patients would go, there might be a mass spectrometer in the hospital, and that's already difficult to get samples in a high enough quality or in a good enough quality that they can be used for this type of analytics. But I think you're talking about other areas of the world where, like, there's no mass spectrometer kilometers around where the patient might be, right?
Yeah, and there is no stable electricity. So what do you do? The vacuum. I mean, how do you even get the solvents of a high enough quality there? Like those things. And we then looked a tiny bit like into who manufactures portable mass spec, and could this method be translated into something that would work on a portable mass spec? Yeah, so after that, I realized this is just not fit for purpose, and then moved on. But, you know, the other thing, at least, that really stayed with me from those years, and this is 15 to 20 years ago, that something that really stayed with me was when you look at the Excel table we put together with the different patients we looked at, and then you see the age of these people and the name, like this was like, yeah, these people are younger than me, and they are, some of them are dead. And it really goes from, this is not a sample. This is the human being who is really behind this. And that sounds naive in a way, but it changed my whole approach to ideals with research in a way.
And so it takes you out of the lab and the chemistry and really towards seeking the applications and the relevance of the work you do. I think it's a hard way to get there, but it's also a beautiful development for a scientist, isn't it?
Yeah.
So how did that direct your choices then to where you are today? Because today, like for example, last month you had a very interesting presentation on developing methods to measure steroids in your lab currently, like up to certain standards of quality or reproducibility or just like tracking information. So it's still applications that are close to the patients. Those patients might be in different parts of the world, but there is still that relevance there. So you kept some of that with you, didn't you?
I kept some of that with me. That's true. My main focus is on how can we develop methods or validate methods or change methods so that they do work in a hospital setting. Basically clinical translation. So how can we dumb down a method in such a way that you don't need a very well-trained analytical chemist to do, but you can run this method at scale robustly in an overworked and understuffed as a clinical lab. That is a huge focus of mine. And the other thing is, we all know these papers where someone say, we've developed and validated a robust method, and this is the revolutionized healthcare. And then you're like, so what do you mean with robust? And what really is the quality? And how have you really validated that? And that is a big learning for me, at least, when I talk more and more to clinicians, or actually not really clinicians, but the laboratory specialists, the clinical chemistry people, the people who are in the lab where there's the mass spec in a hospital, and they're just trying their best to provide good patient care by having methods that are fit for purpose and that meet the quality standards that are necessary to provide patient care. Because at the end of that sample, the result goes to a patient and it has an influence on how a doctor manages and treats her patients.
Yeah.
This result is better correct. It's an ethical issue to provide wrong results. So I'm very, very interested, and this is what I presented in Prague last month. I'm very interested in understanding how clinical labs manage to provide really good quality and how we, in a research context, can adopt these methods, these protocols, these thought processes, and come up with a similar quality in our own research methods. Without scaring the heck out of everyone in the research lab. Obviously, the research can't, that's not the raison d'etre for research, right? To be reproducible and standardized and all of it.
Exactly.
Right?
So this is, for me, a really interesting point. So in my work, I interact a lot with let's say, academic researchers, especially people who develop their own methods and who are looking for the new things, the new, very detailed method to find something. These people are artists. This is how I see them. I was discussing this with a colleague the other day. So I really see that like painters, they have their own techniques and they're so skilled at their art. And then if you ask those people to paint the same painting 100 times, they will die inside.
Die, yeah.
And these are two completely different jobs, like the standardization and the making something that's robust and reproducible. And also in the case of clinical metabolomics, also metabolomics or use of metabolomics in regions where you wouldn't have, or like you would only have aspect to a portable mass spec, for example. Like what you want to see is not the most beautiful thing. You just want to see like the one useful thing that you can actually act on and make a diagnosis or make a treatment choice on. And I think, in my view, these two analytical chemists are completely different people with different goals and different ambitions. But we might put them together and think that they do the same work, but they don't.
They don't. And they shouldn't, because we need both.
Absolutely.
And what we need is that we come up with proper definitions and a language.
Mm-hmm.
Translation of research findings. Mm-hmm. Translation also means that the language has to work in both contexts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when we say, I validated a method, what does it actually mean? And the first time we validated a method here by showing that it's really robust if we inject it 500 times, yeah, that doesn't matter to any clinician, because if this was just done on reference material,
yeah.
Who cares? If you haven't tried it on patients,
yeah.
Right? On real, like, mm-hmm. free-range humans.
It's a very ivory tower kind of situation, yeah. So I think we should just go directly to the second paper we wanted to talk and then we talk about, and then we can go back to the other one, because I did want to get your perspective on this paper you put out, I think, last year, that was called A Global Perspective on the Status of Clinical Metabolomics in Laboratory Medicine. A survey by the IFCC Metabolomics Working Group. So you're one member of a team that has put this together, but you're often, at least in the places where I go for conferences, you're one of the people I've seen presenting these results. And what did you learn in that survey, and how can we improve the work we do in the clinics with metabolomics based on this? Can you tell us more?
Yeah. Can I briefly tell you what the IFCC is?
Of course, please. Please do.
I think most scientists would not necessarily know what the IFCC is. The IFCC is the International Federation for Clinical Chemistry and Laboratory Medicine. And it's the governing body and the umbrella for all those people in clinical labs, like in those basements and hospitals who churn out all these results. And some of them are doing mass spec. Not everyone, obviously. Actually, only a small portion of them are doing mass spec. And within the IFCC, the International Federation, they have different divisions. One of these divisions is called the Emerging Technology Division. And the Emerging Technology Division is where we, as the Metabolomics Working Group, fall under. The Emerging Technology Division is looking for disruptive technologies that one day might be translated from an academic lab into a clinical lab, into the market. And one of the emerging technologies they identified is metabolomics. Aha! And then they decided to form this metabolomics working group,
mm-hmm.
on emerging technologies division of the IFCC. And I'm one of the invited members on this working group. We are very international. There's a website, like if you want to look it up, IFCC Metabolomics Working Group. And we come from quite different backgrounds scientifically with this working group. And we wanted to understand, how does the world see where clinical metabolomics stands right now? What really is the status? And then we wrote a survey comprised of, I forgot how many questions, maybe 35 or something.
Quite a few, yes.
Mm-hmm. There are quite a few, and it took us a while. So one challenge was to define, among our working group, like, what are the crucial questions? And then we realized that we are already within us, we speak different languages, and we had to figure out what are the correct words to make it clear what the question really is to the different diverse people who answered that survey. And then that was fun. And then, we advertised the heck. I sent it to like everyone on LinkedIn, everyone I know. We had like close to 400 people filled the survey, which is which I was flabbergasted by how many people
really replied.
It's really good. It was very interesting. We published it as an open access paper. And my biggest learning from this survey is that, well, it's a no-brainer. We all have very different definitions of what clinical metabolomics is. Like, we can't even agree on what is metabolomics. And of course, we can't agree on what actually is clinical. Like, what is, Alice, what is clinical? The clinical mean it's not a mouse model?
Oh, right. I didn't expect that one. Yeah.
Yeah, the clinical mean if we just look at cohorts, the biobanked cohorts, is that clinical? Just because one of them had, like, it was a disease cohort. Is that already clinical? Is clinical really concerned about actual patients? A cleaner. It's clean, like the lesson for cleaner. Yeah. So what is...
I had a similar discussion with Gary Miller. You maybe know him from the exposome field. And he organized, with colleagues, they organized like a mini symposium where they ended up just spending days trying to define the word exposome.
Yeah.
And they realized, like, among themselves, and they're all agreeing on the overall goals and everything, but still they had to sit down for several days just to come up with a definition that then they published a few months later, and that now is the definition that the field can take with them and then move with. But we need this in every field. It's really, really important when you hear the differences in how people understand the most essential words of what you want to do, of course. Then you have to begin with this. So I think it was a really important part of your work already, even before sending out the questionnaire.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But now we have the survey and people, quite a number of them, of the participants, say that, yes, indeed, they are already using clinical metabolomics. They're already using metabolomics for healthcare. But how do we define metabolomics? So it's lovable. This is very controversial. And even within our own working group, we don't have the same opinion about it. If someone is doing all the steroids that they are, is that metabolomics? I think it's not metabolomics. This is, to me, steroidomics. Right? If someone is doing, if you put lipidomics, if someone is measuring the four ceramides, that's not lipidomics. That is a panel of four analytes. If someone is doing newborn screening, where you measure lots of metabolites in individual panels, is that metabolomics? Or is it just a very vast array of individual analytes in multiple panels? Like, is that metabolomics? So
but what you're getting to is maybe is targeted metabolomics metabolomics? Because these are small targeted panels, you know? So
Yeah, true.
Or is it just the number and the diversity of the molecules that makes it become metabolomics?
Or is it
metabolomics a spectrum?
Isn't everything a spectrum?
So, these days.
My current working definition of it is, for me, metabolomics, a metabolomics essay is an essay that quantitates. We can argue on quantitative versus quantitative. But if, like, an essay that depicts multiple, like really many metabolites representing all main pathways. Because there's a lot of redundancy. For example, just drawing an analogy to lipidomics, which I know a lot better than metabolomics, there are tens of thousands of different lipids, and there's a lot of redundancy within the lipids. And if you measure 1,000 lipids or fit for purpose assay of like 250 lipids, you see very similar things.
That means you get a representative sample of the whole lot is...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You get a representative panel that reflects the vein or all important slides.
Okay. So there was a lot of work on those definitions at the IFCC Metabolomics Working Group. And then you sent out the survey. You got the results. And what was the result that surprised you the most in that survey? Do you remember something that you didn't expect and that was really striking for you?
Yeah. I didn't expect how many people call what they do metabolomics, even though we didn't agree on that this is already metabolomics.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the other things, one question was, how do you see metabolomics moving into the clinical field? And where do you see metabolomics can provide the strongest impact?
Mm-hmm.
And the results were not surprising. The results were, I think, but not, like that's what most of us work somehow in cardiometabolic diseases and in health and in endocrinology. We also asked, what do you think is the biggest hurdle? A lot of people said that what we need to advance the field of metabolomics to the clinical lab is reference materials, and we need to work towards traceability, metrological traceability.
Mm-hmm.
We need to really have molar concentrations, and we need to know that these concentrations are correct and true.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the things we do, I think the metabolomics and the lipidomics communities, we are really interested in having good results and in providing correct results. And we participate in all these ring trials.
Mm-hmm.
We publish values that are concordant, basically consensus values.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't necessarily know what the truth is, the metrological traceable truth. And we know this for a few analytes, but we don't know this, obviously, for the vast majority of and it's important to know that we can provide results and our methods work well enough that we can provide results and values that are metrologically traceable. Also the kilogram, you know?
Yeah.
So the Paris, basically.
Yeah, and this is really something that you need when you get to the clinical application of metabolomics. So this brings me back to one of the things that surprised me in Prague. There were a few workshops on standardization of metabolomics because, of course, it's a big topic. When you get to how to do that standardization, I think you see the separation between people who do more research-based, more exploratory metabolomics and people who are really looking for that application in the clinics. Something that really surprised me that I hadn't heard before was rather than focusing on standardizing the methods, we want to standardize to focus on standardizing the reporting of how we did the experiment.
Ah, yeah.
And when I heard that, I see the value of that because it's very like if you want to reuse data, there's a huge value for it. Like if you want to reproduce what someone did or if you want to just integrate different data sets together, the better you understand what was done, the more it helps to really bring things together. But if I think of an application to the clinic or to be able to measure in different places the same thing, which is what you do in the different ring trials that you organize with the ALS, you need to... It's an interesting one with the ALS. Maybe you have a comment on that. So I know that, I think it was the ceramides, like people were using different methods and then you were comparing the concentrations. But there are really cases where you want different labs to have the same method rather than to have the same way of reporting what they did and the results that they got. But I was very surprised by this idea of let's standardize the reporting of the method. And maybe you have a comment on this, both like in general for the clinical metabolomics or lipidomics, and then the ILS, so the International Lipidomics Society ring trial is a different topic. But what are your thoughts on this?
The CERMAT ring trial, the results have been published. There's a beautiful paper by the last author, is Federico Torta from Sling. The ring trial, there were over 30 labs who analyzed exactly the same material with exactly the same internal standards. Mm-hmm. And they only analyzed 4 ceramides, and each ceramide had its authentic internal standard. And the participants were free to use their own method. I think this is what you're referring to. They could use their own method, or they could use the method that was written up very nice in a SOP and circulated by Federico's team. And the results were pretty comparable. And it's nice to see that truth should be regardless of the method, right? Truth should be the truth. And it shouldn't matter which method you're using.
Especially when it's quantitative,
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But that was good. And
so that worked well with 4 analytes. Because I think this is where the discussion is going now, when you want to
True. So for
like the broader metabolomics, then it becomes more complicated to have an authentic standard for each one of them.
Yeah, it does. We're doing another ring trial as part of the Clinical Lipidomics Interest Group of the International mm-hmm. Lipidomics Society, which we call the Lipidome Ring Trial. And it's for close to 160 different lipids. Mm-hmm. And we have about 35 or so internal standards. Mm-hmm. And everyone can do whatever they want, basically. But everyone had to use the same extraction method, at least. Because it matters. Like everyone had to use a very well-described extraction method, plus the liberty of using, in addition, their own extraction method. Because we know how much variation comes from the extraction. Yes. And I think that has to really, really well describe. So, yeah, I agree mm-hmm. that describing how we do things and, probably also describing how we analyze the data, that is really mm-hmm. important. But you know what we don't talk about, I think, Alice, is we have to describe the demographics of the samples. Like once we move away from reference materials, and we analyze the free-range human.
The full system.
And how do we... And that's where I see the biggest hurdle moving forward. We have okay methods and they become better. And we will have reference materials. And some of the reference materials will have assigned values that are metrologically traceable. So then we don't have to fight any longer which method is the best. Everyone just uses those reference materials and we shall see the results. And it will be very clear for which analytes, which method is the best or, good enough, right? So once we know what the true values are, everyone can use whatever method, whatever extraction, whatever, and we just very objectively so can see which methods work well for which analytes, which throughput.
But was that the goal of the ceramide ring trial you organized, to find the best method? Or was it rather to see if it was comparable between the different methods?
Yes. It was rather to see, can we come up with concordant values? But for the Lipidome ring trial, you can choose different methods. Shotgun, reverse phase, supercritical fluid, like all sorts of stuff. Mm-hmm. Like we want to see which methods or platforms work well.
That's it.
Or which lipid classes. But then, you know what bothers me? Let's say we have great methods, great platforms, great reference materials, great databases, well-trained people, everything's. Mm-hmm. And now we throw that at the population. Mm-hmm. And then we measure all sorts of things and we have no idea mm-hmm. which differences matter.
Yeah.
We don't know if high concentration of whatever matters or not.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't know if this was just high at this particular time point, and we don't understand enough about the circadian rhythm. We don't understand enough of all the other things. I mean, the microbiome, the genetics, the drug interactions, we do not understand natural variation.
Yeah.
We do not understand the boundaries of biology. And we need to be careful about not pathologizing biology.
Absolutely.
And we don't even know reference ranges for these things. We don't know what the normal boundaries are. We don't know what are the normal boundaries for all these different lipids.
Yeah, and it's really interesting always, I see, whether it's from Sling or probably other groups in Singapore, but Very often when you see a talk that is about multi-ethnic cohorts, very often it's going to come from Singapore because it's a country where there's a huge melting pot of people from different parts of Asia and very different genetic background and very different metabolomes. And mm-hmm. I'm always very interested in those studies because you start to go into one of the highest levels of complexity for metabolomics and lipidomics, that is this inherent biological difference between people who are like roughly comparable, but there are those small differences. And those ones, as you said, like we have to be careful not to turn them into pathology or like being out of the reference range just because mm-hmm. you're not exactly comparable with what was used to create that reference range. And maybe mm-hmm. it's a good transition for the other paper we wanted to discuss together. It's mm-hmm. one that's focusing on PFAS, so those very, very famous environmental contaminants and plasma lipidomics in multi-ethnic Asian subjects for exposome research. So could you tell us a bit about that study or also just in general about working with lipidomics in these multi-ethnic cohorts? What have you learned there and what can you share with us?
Yeah, sure. That study was driven by Sartaj Ahmed Mir, who's a very talented DNA scientist at SLING. And he developed a method to analyze about a dozen, at that stage, a dozen different PFAS in human plasma samples. He basically ordered all internal standards he could get hold of. And the method is now growing, because whatever comes on the market, we purchase. So he's expanding this panel. But at that particular stage, the panel was about a dozen different PFAS, including the legacy PFAS, like the really bad ones, PFOA and PFOS, which have been banned because they are carcinogens.
Well, I'm sure you can still measure them in samples by definition.
You can still measure them.
Even though they've been banned. Yeah.
Yes, because it takes mm-hmm. a while to get them out of our body. There's a reason why they're called forever chemicals. They're nearly indestructible. The half-life in the human body is about something like 3.5 years. So we pee them out and we bile acids them out. And we also shed them via blood. Mm-hmm. There's a paper on bloodletting, basically blood donation. People who donate a lot of blood have lower concentrations of PFAS.
So here you go, donate your blood.
Yeah. He measured the levels of these 12 or so PFAS in human plasma. Oh, by the way, the levels of PFOS and PFOA that have been banned, those levels are already going down in plasma. In populations who have measured them over time. So in Australia, for example, they've measured them over time. And there you already see the concentrations go down. So if regulation kicks in and has been followed, then this has a positive effect. What we are trying to do in Singapore right now is move this whole PFAS measuring into biomonitoring, basically monitoring what are the levels of different PFAS in the blood of the population, so that at least we understand baseline exposure and can monitor trends over time. And here, one problem is, of course, we measure targeted. So how do we deal with industry adapting to regulations and replacing banned PFAS by other molecular species, which aren't part of the targeted panel? So this whole thing comes into what is the clinical utility really of targeted versus untargeted, and how do you understand what else is out there? And the whole field of the environmental and toxicologists, they discuss this quite a lot. You want to know the method of going into this.
And there's still differences. The PFAS level itself. But you don't know, of course, if it's genetics or if it's just also lifestyle.
Correct. Right. And we cannot really draw very strong conclusions from this particular paper, because it was less than 100 people.
Sure.
So it's really like a small cohort at this stage. Mm-hmm. We do know, though, from larger studies in the US, for example, where Caucasians and Black Americans in the US were compared, and because there's a very strong association between FIFA levels in the blood and your socioeconomic status.
Yeah.
And this is something that we always have to keep in mind. I think, you know, we talk about ethnicity and the genetic component, but I'm really not an expert in this, like zero. I'm far from being an expert in this, but I do see again and again that what main matters is what do people eat and how much money do they have to eat good
things. Absolutely.
And where does the main PFAS contamination come from? So we get PFAS from whatever we eat can already be contaminated with PFAS. For example, the factory makes PFAS, it goes into the drinking water, it goes into the ocean, I think it's rivers and the oceans, and the fish have it in the fish. We eat the fish. This, like, that's one source of PFAS contamination.
Mm-hmm.
Or anything else we eat, right, that's already contaminated. And of course, the drinking water, but also inhalation from Gore-Tex, for example, is basically PFAS. Mm-hmm. So like dust or fabrics
That's very interesting. So in the paper, you measured, of course, the PFAS with this targeted method. And then you also looked at the lipidome of these individuals.
Mm-hmm.
So did you see any associations there? Anything you could assume then comes from the impact of the chemicals on the biology of those individuals?
Well, we know that the PFAS bioaccumulate in the liver.
Mm-hmm.
That means that the PFAS go into the liver and they stay there and accumulate in the liver. And they mess up the liver metabolism, which is basically the lipid metabolism. And in our paper, to be honest, I don't remember exactly which lipid species were mainly perturbed, but we do know that PFAS have an effect on lipid metabolism. And also, we know from clinical guidelines, a very, very few clinical guidelines on what do you do if a patient or a concerned individual, like if a human being has elevated PFAS concentrations, what do you do? Right? What is the clinical utility and the actionability of elevated PFAS levels? What do you do? And there is a guideline called the ASTM guideline that says that if you have 0 to 2 nanogram per milliliter concentration, nothing, like no concern. If you have 2 to 20 nanogram per milliliter concentrations, then you should monitor a bit more closely. And if you have concentrations above 20, then you should really check for dyslipidemia and have more frequent checks because, so that's one known effect of PFAS on the body that people end up with unexplained sort of dyslipidemia. One problem or one issue we are facing right now is we measure PFAS. But what do clinicians do with this information?
Mm-hmm.
And the clinician will only care about this information if they have a way of dealing with this information and understanding if this really changes anything and really has an impact on patient management and is really going to improve outcomes. So, for example, even if that's what I hear from clinicians, I discuss this with, even if we know that PFAS concentrations are associated with, let's say, thyroid function, like impaired thyroid function, and messed up liver enzymes, and dyslipidemia, and these three facts seem to be facts. Even if we know that, and if we then try to intervene and change lifestyle to reduce exposure, so that PFAS concentration and the individual go down. No one, of course, has demonstrated that then your liver enzymes will go back to normal and your thyroid function will go back to normal, right? So actionability really to a clinician means that, okay, I can do something with this data on elevated levels, I now know I have to do something and treat this patient differently. Like this person now becomes a patient, right? I can do something about
it. Yep.
And it's really actionable because now I can intervene and, you know, suggest lifestyle changes. And then it really has an impact. It really changes our outcomes. So, and we don't have that yet, for example.
Yeah, yeah. But this is for me the hardest part of the translation is to find. So, of course, to go from association to really understanding, at least seeing that if you remove the chemical in that case, that you lose the negative effect. So it's a form of clinical trial, although it's always difficult, especially if you do that through lifestyle intervention. This is not necessarily the type of clinical trial that people want to put forward. They're usually more interested in having another active component that is going to make that go down. But yeah, it's the steps that we need to have also then to go into the next guideline that is going to recommend that, yes, you should lower those levels of chemicals in the patient so that you can expect the positive effects. This all takes a lot of time, I assume.
Now, back to your question on what should be reported. So, right, we report the methods, but then we also do report the data and the extraction and all of that. But we also have to report what did people eat and how did they eat it? Like, what kind of packaging was it in? And
yeah,
those things. It's way more complicated.
These are very difficult topics. I mean, we've really had an interesting episode so far because we touched on a lot of slightly controversial topics where there are lots of stakeholders that are involved in those different discussions. And I think this is really also where science and research meets society, where you get to the types of finding that eventually will have an impact on society. But there's this little friction in the middle that is always happening. And that once you go through it, then you can really have the effects on the population. It was a lot of different angles. It was a coincidence, I think, that we ended up having all those discussions. But maybe that's a consequence of talking about your work.
So, and then, of course, the question is, how do you want to involve the general public in this? Mm-hmm. And how do you make this participatory? Mm-hmm. A lot of countries now work on patient-centric sampling, basically micro-sampling, right? And in other countries, not in Singapore, but in other countries, you can order a PFAS test yourself. Because since there are no guidelines currently,
yes,
it's difficult to reimburse it. Insurances, why would an insurance pay for this if there's no guideline and no actionability yet? So basically concern individuals. They can go to a company called Million Markers. And I just had a chat with Jenna Hua, H-U-A, yesterday. And I think she's fantastic. And she started the company 6 years ago because she wanted to know her PFAS levels and nobody offered that testing. And then she started her own company and that company offers exactly that. So as a concerned individual, you can order your at-home sampling kit. And then you submit, in this case, it's urine because it's easier with urine than with blood.
That's how we excrete it. It makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, people are more likely to get urine sampling right than they get blood sampling right. Peeing is easier than pricking yourself.
Back to the practicalities of sample collection. Yeah.
And the ethics. And the ethics, right? And it's not infectious. Better to ship and everything. So, concerned individuals can get their PFAS levels tested. And we can move, I hope that we can move with PFAS into so-called citizen sciences. And move into rolling out a program where people can use micro-sampling devices. And there are various commercial devices available where people can self-test. We all use from COVID, we all used to self-testing at home, right?
Yes.
And you can self-test and you ship in your device to a lab that is accredited to do this kind of work and get that result. This obviously only works if the whole process is so well controlled and the lab methods and the reporting is so well controlled that everything is done to make sure that the results are correct, because you do not want to induce any unnecessary anxiety by having wrong
most positive results.
That might well come from the plastics in the microsampling device or something, right? So this goes back to why am I fascinated by this extremely boring topic of ISO 15189, which I presented in Prague. I really thought, why would a researcher want to listen to ISO 15189? Yes, because us researchers, we can learn a lot from how clinical labs manage to get quality right.
Yeah. Actually, the implementation in a clinical context is always a specific struggle, I think, in every location. And yeah. So we're getting towards the end of the episode. I would ask you, you know, in this season, we focus on 5P medicine. And I mean, we've spent the whole episode talking about participatory medicine just now, population-based, precision medicine, and preventive predictive. Do you have a favorite that drives you more of those 5Ps?
So all of them at once right now. I'm mostly interested in involving everyone who needs to be involved, basically the participatory. And that is because I think we need to really democratize healthcare. And we need to make sure that everyone is really invited to participate. And I'm not sure this is really how the definition was intended. It goes back to my grievance back then with tuberculosis. If we do all of these fancy things and continue to invest all this taxpayers and investors money in doing fantastic, great science, and it doesn't go to where it needs to go, and it doesn't touch positively the lives of the people who actually need it, then I'm not interested.
Yeah, and then all those efforts are for nothing. I mean,
of course, I'm still interested, right? I mean, it's still interesting science about that, and I do see purpose of that as well. But I'm mainly interested in doing something that really helps the individual people. In countries and settings where they don't have access to all the fancy stuff we have access to.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah.
And I think it's time for our last question. Are you ready? What is your favorite metabolite and why? And of course, lipids are allowed.
My favorite metabolite, I guess everyone expects me to say ceramides, because I mainly talk about
that is so on the nose. Come on.
My favorite metabolite is tuberculostearic acid.
Tell us more.
Tuberculostearic acid. Tuberculostearic acid is a fatty acid that is only there. It only exists in those bacteria that cause tuberculosis. So Mycobacterium tuberculosis has tuberculostearic acid. It's called tuberculostearic because it's based on acetic acid, but it has a methylation on it. So the biosynthesis is you at position between C8 and C9, you introduce a double bond, and then that double bond gets through a short epoxy transformation, then opens up and becomes a monomethylation at C8, at C9, I think. And then this becomes a C19, right? An odd chain. Just that it's not a really odd chain. It's still C18, but it has this monomethylation on it, okay?
Yeah.
So, and humans don't have monomethylated fatty acids, apart from apparently a newborn has some waxy stuff on their skin that has methylation on it. But apart from that, the human would not have tuberculostearic acid or any other monomethylated acid in them unless they have bacteria in them, right? It could be a nice biomarker for the existence of mycobacteria in a human if you find tuberculostearic acid in a human. So I like tuberculostearic acid because back in the day, it's like 20 years ago, when I looked at mycobacteria, what I thought was fascinating was that tobacco-like acid containing lipids go up in this weird dormancy phase. So when the bacteria in the body enter this kind of sleeping state and dormancy, mm-hmm. they have a high ratio of tobacco-like acid as opposed to oleic acid or ostearic acids. And yeah, I like that whole part, that this could really serve as a biomarker, just that obviously back then we could pursue this because the concentrations were really low, and not even if you can detect tuberculosic acid by mass spec, who cares? Because where the patients are,
yeah,
we don't have.
There is no mass spec, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's still my most favorite analyte. Mm-hmm. And thank you for inviting me to the podcast and asking me this question, because it really made me think a lot again about tuberculosis and realizing this. It's a shame that after all these years, we still have 1.3 million people a year dying, even though we have drugs. And, you know, we have drugs that work. They are a pain in the neck because you need to take them for many months. But, you know, cancer drugs, we also take for many, many, many months, right? And we still go through it. But we have drugs and we still have all these deaths, and we have the always looming sword in the background that there will be multi-drug resistant, and then what, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a disgrace to humanity that we let a disease that we know from Thomas Mann and the Second World War, and from the mummies, you know, the mummies had tuberculosis. Like we've lived with tuberculosis, but we still die of tuberculosis. And in 2025, and what happens? We cut down funding for these things.
That's right.
Yeah,
that makes me really sad.
Mm-hmm. Despite my love for bacteria, I do hope Mycobacterium tuberculosis just has to go home.
Yeah. That's a great message. Thank you. Thank you for sharing your passion about not just the metabolite, but the whole topic. I think it is what makes us choose our favorite metabolites, is also these more passionate aspects that we have for not just the science, and this is really a topic that came again and again in this episode, but also the impact, the relevance that it has for society. And whether it's the people that we see next door or it's people that are on the other side of the planet, like you do hope as a scientist that the work that you do then is beneficial for the entire planet and for the humans and also for the environment, actually. So,
Yeah.
Thank you for also for sharing your view on this.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of The Metabolomist, where we uncovered new ways in which metabolomics and multiomics are driving breakthroughs in 5P medicine, the powerful framework that's shaping the future of healthcare. If you enjoyed this conversation and want to stay updated, subscribe to our newsletter at themetabolomist.com to be the first to know when our next episode drops. Until then, I hope you get to keep exploring the fascinating world of metabolomics.